Travolting presents Bobbin for Robin. Hosted by Jeff Sweeney and Stuart Elmore. Covering the best of times. Enjoy the episode. All right, I'm going to get started with a little clip. You ready?
Yes, I'm ready.
Which were shooting a football game at night for 2.5 weeks in the, in the rain. I think maybe they had the opportunity then to say, well, maybe we should put these into the day.
On form, be careful. They got Dr. Death covering you.
No sweat. I thought he was still in jail.
No, he's on parole.
Parole?
On four. Ready?
Yes, that was a clip of Kurt Russell being interviewed for the movie that came out in January 1986, The Best of
It was
times.
The best of times. It was the worst of times.
Best of times, the worst of times. And it, funny, you should say that a metaphor, Jeff, because we're also kind of going through a similar best and worst for Robin in this kind of period.
Yeah, it's an interesting period for his career because, like, of the four people we've talked about so far,
yeah,
all of that, like, the first three were actors.
Yes.
Like, that was their only real, like, career trip.
They had one column.
Travolta had a little sidebar into, you know, book writing.
Yeah.
But
yes. Yes, he
aside
did.
Aside from that, they're just actors.
Yeah. One column called their acting job.
Robin was spinning a few plates.
Robin had two columns. He had his comedian column and he had his actor column. And it's no accident we're calling this first era the comedian because that's the column that's really on the rise right now. So welcome back to Travolting Presents Bobbin for Robin. Thank you for
it's
listening
true.
Last week to Moscow on the Hudson.
Moscow on the Hudson.
Listening to...
Boy.
From what I remember, we record... It's been a little bit of a gap since our recording sessions. From what I remember, the episode hasn't come out yet in our time. But I remember we were like...
Yeah, we were like, it was good.
It was like, a pretty okay movie. And so I guess, like, I'm just going to dive right into some context. I have a fair bit of context for this episode.
Yes.
Do know that if you're binging through and the next one you're going to come up to after this is Club Paradise, this episode and next week's episode Club Paradise are kind of like pushed together in like a chapter of Robin's life.
Yeah.
Cause they all come out the same year, 1986. Best of Times comes out in January, which means it was shot in 85. But in terms of the year 86, it's a huge year for Robin. So let me just go back a little bit to his film career. Like we said, last week you listed Moscow on the Hudson, Week Before the Survivors, Week Before World According to Garp, Popeye being his like unofficial inaugural first movie. So Popeye, which we've clarified, it's like, while not like a critical success, like it does make money and people watch it.
Yeah.
People go and see it. People recognize Robin for it. It's kind of hitting home more of like that cartoonish character that he's known for with Mork. Then we go to The World According to Garp, his first dramatic role. People are a little bit off-put by this, and it also goes to the fact that Robin's working with a director that doesn't quite know how to utilize him with no improvising. When that movie doesn't do so well, he kind of reverts back and goes to his spitballing fastball comedy improvisation
style. Yeah, he kind of just goes right into comedy move. Like,
yeah.
I mean, Moscow on the Hudson's like a dramedy.
Moscow on the Hudson's a very much like a dramedy. It's also playing off of like Robin's comedic chops, being that he does a lot of Russian accents in his act. And now we're on to The Best of Times, which is a small movie.
Yeah.
It's not like, I think the budget it was made for was $12 million.
It's a sports comedy.
It's a sports
comedy. It's a mid-tier sports comedy.
Mid-tier sports comedy. A lot of which in the 80s, there are many, this being one of them. And so actually in the clip that I played, I skipped a little bit ahead, but they do talk about how like there was a sports comedy movie that was coming out literally just a month after their movie was coming out. And so, yeah, sports comedy starring Robin Williams and Kurt Russell. This is advertised as a two-hander movie between the two of them. Now, Kurt Russell is doing pretty good. He's on the rise right now.
Kurt Russell's in a very weird period of his career.
Yeah.
Because he's like in the middle of his John Carpenter run.
Yeah.
Which, you know, starts with Elvis, Escape from New York, The Thing. And then after this movie is Big Trouble in Little China, which is their last collaboration. All of those being movies that like didn't really like escape until like the stratosphere. Like those are all
King
movies
hits later.
Those are all movie like The Thing is hated when it comes out. Everybody hates it. It flops. People are like, worst movie ever made.
Maybe I'm misrepresenting where he is then at his career.
Well, this is the thing is like when you look back in hindsight, it looks like Kurt Russell's on a hot streak.
Okay.
Because these are all good movies.
Yeah.
Like the Thing is now considered a classic. Like,
well, and there's one that you missed that wasn't John Carpenter. Silkwood from directed by Mike Nichols.
Yeah.
That he does a few years just before this movie.
And he does Swing Shift with Jonathan Demme.
Yeah.
And
mean
he's
Season.
Used Cars with Robert Zemeckis.
Yeah.
Like he's kind of at this point where it's like Kurt Russell, looking back on it, should be like at a Harrison Ford, type space at this time.
Right.
But none of these John Carpenter movies that are now universally beloved are successful in their time.
Fascinating.
Like
okay.
Escape from New York is like the one that's kind of a success.
Yeah.
But
okay.
The Thing, you look back on now, it's like one of his best performances and everybody loves that movie.
Yeah.
The same with Big Trouble in Little China.
So then I guess he's coming off of, let me ask you this question then, Jeff. Were they commercial flops?
Yes.
Okay, so then in this case, it sort of changes the tonality of where Kurt Russell is then, in which he's kind of reverting to like a popcorn movie.
Yeah, like everybody knows who Kurt Russell is at this time.
Yeah.
But he still has that like, because he was, you know, a Disney child star.
Yes.
Famously, the last words Walt Disney ever uttered, he on his deathbed, on the last day of his life, he grabbed a piece of paper and a pen and he scribbled Kurt Russell. And then he died.
Is this real?
This is true.
Oh my gosh.
I mean, he didn't die immediately, but the last thing Walt Disney ever said was Kurt Russell.
Robin Williams does this bit on a lot of his stand-up where he says, Ronald Reagan, what a guy. It's almost as if Disney's last wish before he died was, make a president.
Yeah. Yeah. it was not make a president. It was Kurt Russell.
Kurt Russell.
Like, imagine living your entire life just knowing, like, on his deathbed, Walt Disney just wrote my name on a piece of paper and then dropped dead.
Wow.
Must be strange. Kurt Russell must think about it every fucking day.
I would.
Because you have no, like, he was a Disney child star at the time. It's not like he, you know, didn't.
It's weird calling him a Disney child star in the sense that, like, he's a Disney. We think of Disney child stars like Disney Channel. But you're talking he's a Disney child star in the sense of, like, older movies that he.
I'm talking like
as a kid, in the 60s.
What's the really funny named one? I'm talking like Follow Me, Boys. That's not the one I'm thinking of. There's one like Dad, the Computer Came to Life or something like that.
The Man from U.N.C.L.E.
No.
Travels of Jamie McFeeders. Our Man
Magical
Higgins.
Disney.
11th Hour. Sam Benedict.
I promise you I'm going to find
TV
this.
Movies.
Dad, can I borrow that car?
Interesting. Oh, okay. I see. Oh, he's the narrator.
I'm gonna find the specific one that I'm thinking of because it has such a funny title.
Yeah.
Well,
it's interesting. So then, like Kurt Russell. Then I guess I should walk that back a little bit. He's kind of in
the
like,
computer wore tennis shoes.
Okay, good.
This
good.
Is it. This the is computer wore tennis shoes.
Good stuff.
And it's like they make a computer come to life. And it's like 1960 something, and they're like, "Wow, this computer's gonna change the world, huh?" 1969 though.
Yeah.
Oh my God, it's walking! It's a computer. They don't even know the word robot yet. They do know the word robot yet.
Yeah.
But he's like, he's a child star, who tries around 1980 to break out, and he does. He's very smart. And what he tries to break out with is he does Elvis as a TV movie with John Carpenter, which doesn't really, you know, go anywhere, but it connects him with Carpenter, who uses him strongly over the next decade.
Yeah.
And it is Used Cars, which is such like a rejection of his persona as a child star.
Yeah.
Because he's playing a used car salesman. And that movie's so much about like politicians and like how they're just used car salesmen in different suits.
Yeah.
And then he goes right into the Carpenter run. I mean, he still does the voice of the Fox and the Hound in this period.
Very good.
But like you know, it's not like people are going to see The Fox and the Hound because Kurt Russell is voicing the dog.
Yeah.
The Hound, I should say.
Copper.
Copper. But, like, he does Escape from New York, The Thing, Swing Shift, right before this movie.
All so, things that would later become like big hits,
yeah.
but not at the time. So then I guess this is interesting because for Kurt Russell then to go to this movie, The Best of Times, which is not really made by, like, a known director, Roger...
Spottiswood.
Spottiswood.
I spotted it, trust me.
Sorry. Spottiswood. Written by Ron Shelton, who I think at this point had a, I think he wrote the screenplay for Bad Boys 2.
Fuck yeah, he did.
And he also wrote White Man Can't Jump in 92.
It's a great career.
Yeah. Well, I'm saying, like, all these came after. So, like, the stuff that he's done prior, like, his first screenwriting credit on IMDb is The Pursuit of D.B. Cooper in 1981, Under Fire
in 1983.
Well, they didn't find him. Right.
They didn't find D.B. Cooper. What are you talking about? The Pursuit of D.B. Cooper? They never figured out who he was.
I don't know. Maybe.
What does that movie end with? Going around being like, I don't know.
Didn't go anywhere, man.
Or did they do like a Zodiac thing where they find like John Carroll Lynch sitting in the diner and he looks at him?
They just leave it off like
cuts
that.
Cuts to black, directed by David Fincher.
But there's the only appeal to picking this movie is literally just the fact of like it's the mid 80s. A lot of sports comedies movies are coming out around this time. And it seems kind of like a safe hit. This is a safe movie on paper.
Well, to me, the Russell of this all, the Kurt, as it were, it seems like. When he's trying to break out, this is something of, and this is not a Kurt Russell podcast, but like, this is kind of a retreat for him.
Yeah.
Because this is exactly the type of movie you'd expect a former child star to make 15 to 20 years later.
Yes.
It's a movie about them being a washed up high school, like former high school quarterback.
Yes. Yes.
And the whole movie is about him regaining that like heist, that youthful vigor that he had.
Yeah, I think I am going to save a lot
because
of the
action. If Zac Efron did this movie right now, it would make sense.
Exactly, yeah.
Now, he obviously went in a different career path.
Yeah.
But if Zac Efron had not done like The Iron Claw and that kind of stuff, and he had made The Best of Times 2 this year, you'd be like, that makes sense.
That makes a lot of sense, yeah. I think I might actually save a good chunk of like a lot of the 1986 Robin life context for later because this
happens
is
after this movie.
It happens all after this movie. Okay. This movie comes out in January. This is like the first peak. What I will say though, going into it is, I could even say this before the release of this movie is that as we mentioned, Robin's comedian career is taking off at this time.
Yeah.
At the current status, he's like released, I believe at least two comedy albums who are, both, I think, big successes. He's going on a lot of tours all over the country. He's performing at nightclubs everywhere still. Something I do want to make clear, like, you know, we I think it was Moscow on the Hudson and prior, we talked about Robin's, like, substance abuse issues and things like that. He's still going through that around this rough time. It's a little bit after when I think the author of his biography and other folks close to him is when he sort of dials down. And I mention all that because Robin is also... a father at this point. He's a father to his son, Zach Williams, who's 3 years old around this time. And that's going to be a huge influence in a lot of his growth of his comedian stint. He's still married to Valerie at this time, but that marriage is kind of crumbling at this point. It's something interesting I do want to mention in this podcast at this particular episode is when you read about Robin's first marriage with Valerie, you know, it's it very much paints Valerie, I think she's still alive, in a sense of like, this is a good person who is married to this also good person, but is sort of in the throes of fame right now.
Yeah.
And which there's a lot of things that come with that, especially in Robin's comedian field, like drugs, affairs, alcohol, no time spent at home, all those kind of things. When he is home, he's usually exhausted, not really doing things. A lot of things we hear a lot about famous people. But at least the way Dave Itzkoff kind of paints it, I'd be interested to hear if there were any other sides of the story, is that Valerie took that as an occupational hazard.
Yeah.
Like, I'm married to Robin Williams. Of course, all these things are going to happen. He's going to have affairs. He's going to be doing drugs all the time. He's going to be... like hopping off on cocaine on occasion. That comes with the territory. I just want to mention that because it's interesting. It's a when I read this book the first time and I read through that section, I think it's good for audiences who want to dive deeper into like the depths of Robin's like life, both his and his career and his personal life, that that's a very unique perspective that I'd be interested in knowing more about with couples, one of which who's famous and one of which who's not, what that kind of dynamic situation is like. Mm-hmm. Anywho, this movie, shot in 85, comes out in 86. And we'll talk about how it kind of did. There's not much about this in the biography. Again, like as I kind of mentioned, this movie and Club Paradise are kind of paired together as being like, this is like where Robin's film career is. He admits that he kind of took this movie because it was kind of a safe bet. Like it's a sports comedy movie with Kurt Russell. And at this point, Robin looks back at his previous movies, none of which have been like skyrocket takeoffs. Like Popeye, yes, it made money, but it was kind of mixed reviews.
Yeah.
And it didn't really take him anywhere in his
Popeye,
career.
One of those movies that in retrospect, everyone's like, what a massive flop. And it's like, it wasn't.
It wasn't. Like, it wasn't. It wasn't.
It like made money. It just made didn't money. Make as much as you wanted.
Exactly. Well, that's like the Dungeons and Dragons movie this year. Good movie. Made a lot of money, but not all the
Dungeons
money.
Dungeons and Dragons movie like just about made enough to not be a huge loss. But like Popeye made over like double its budget. It's like, it's not like it's a colossal wreck.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, and I'll fast forward to the rest of his other movies. Like nothing's really hit. Nothing's really sticking. Robin's still seen as like this big name comedian, but he's still doing movies. I didn't realize that. Like that's kind of the tonality of Robin's career. Jeff, you were very distracted when you watched this movie.
Yes. No, I mostly remember what happened. It took me about 5 to 6 hours to watch this movie.
Oh my God.
And you told me that it took you a while to watch this movie because you watched it with ads. And so like there'd be ads interrupting.
I don't think I watched this movie with ads.
Or was it Club Paradise?
Club Paradise. No.
You watched a movie with ads that took you a while.
It was the best of times.
Because you had texted me. It took me forever. And I said, well, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to watch the movie quick because I'm going to pay the $2.49 for the standard definition rental, which looks like a fucking potato.
It does. I watched this on Tubi and it's like a cropped image.
Can I shake your hand? I want to shake your hand for watching this on Tubi. Thank you. Okay.
I've been going on Tubi more often.
Tubi is streaming service. You don't even need an account.
You don't need an account. How is it legal?
Tubi is the best. Okay, Tubi sidebar. The thing about Tubi is you'll go on Tubi and it will say like
let him cook.
Action/thriller.
Yes.
And it will be 5 movies you have never heard of before. That'll be like Hunter Killer 6 or Slayer 2, Fire, Man in Trouble. And titles like that with like the worst posters clearly made for like $200,000 in like Cleveland.
It's like
a bunch of those. And then right next to it will be like The Matrix.
Yeah.
But it's like 6 deep behind all these things. That Tubi does not discriminate. Tubi does not care how your movie was made. Tubi does not care when your movie was made. Tubi does not care for how much. Tubi will put your movie in its little box with some of the all-time great classics. And it will not care. It will say, hey, look, so we're going to have Oppenheimer here. But Oppenheimer's like 7th in the drama section behind I Married a Stripper 6. And your wife is sleeping with me too. Like it could behind all these fucking movies.
That's hilarious.
And that is why Tubi's the best. Tubi has an incredible collection of like 60s animated like Christian films.
Oh, fantastic.
That you can find.
I didn't realize this. This is good.
I'm going to be like Moses crossed the desert and it will just be like a static image and then it will just like move across the screen without its legs moving. You're like, did Moses have flotation? Whatever. That's the Tubi sidebar.
I
wanted to hype
I watched this on Tubi. Good. There were some ads. Very good. It extended my watch through. Made it a little difficult to pay attention.
It took so I was like, haha, I will pay the rental so I don't take a long time to watch the movie. It took me 5 hours to watch the movie. Because I started watching it.
Yeah.
And I had my headphones in. I was watching on a computer.
Yeah.
I was like, here I shall sit and I shall watch this movie.
Here I shall sit.
Yes.
And watch this
movie. And then I was just like, I got to finish up this documentation for this application I'm going for.
Yeah.
So I got distracted and I worked on that for a little bit. It's like, I'll go back and I'll finish this movie. then I'll run this to the post office.
Good.
And so I went back and I, you know, sat, I watched a little bit more of the movie. And I was like, and then I got a text message from my landlord saying, hey, let us know if you want to renew by the end of next month. I was like, well, you know, if you're thinking about buying or something like that, I should probably, like, you know, do some research.
This is a deep dive.
Anyway, and then I did basically an hour and a half long pre-qualification process for a mortgage through my bank.
Oh, my God.
And then looked at and booked some tours for condos.
Are you trying to buy before you have to resign?
We have to. I want to know if we're going to buy before we resign.
Okay. Maybe you can bargain for like a shorter lease, but higher rent.
We're thinking about this.
Yeah.
But anyway.
Anyway.
So then I did that, and I'm like, okay, well, that's all I can do today. Yeah. I will go back and finish the movie. So I watched 1 minute of the movie then. And I was like, oh, shit, I got to run this first thing to the post office.
Yeah.
And so I was like, oh, God, it was 2:55, post office closes at 3. So I run into the car, I have the thing, I drive over, get to the post office, 2:58, they have the doors locked. I'm like, well, this is, the Department of Government Efficiency is already going into effect. Elon Musk's having the post office closed 2 minutes early.
Oh, my God.
So I'm like, well, now I'm here at the post office of this thing. So I go to the UPS store. I'm like, hey, can you mail this to Ireland for me? And they're like, yes, but we can't send it to a PO box. You can only do that through the post office. So I waited in the line at the UPS for no reason. Drove back home, came upstairs defeated, got a phone call from my dad, talked to my dad for 10 minutes, hung up from my dad. And then by this point, it's like 4:30 almost. I started this movie at like 11 a.m. And I'm like, you know what? Nothing else. I will sit here and I will finish the best of times.
As you're going through the worst of times.
So I commit. I sit down. I press fucking play on that computer, and I watch the rest of this movie.
Good.
However, it was a very fragmented viewing, to say the least.
Good. Quick summary. This is a movie. Robin is definitely the number one.
Yeah, he's the main character.
It is a two-hander between him and Kurt Russell.
He's the main character in the same way. Like, to type up a movie, it's like Bad Boys, where it's like,
yeah,
Will Smith is the lead of Bad Boys.
Yeah.
But it's a two-hander with Martin Lawrence.
Yeah.
Or like Men in Black, where Will Smith is the lead and Tommy Lee Jones. But Tommy Jones is the two-hander.
You have another one that's Will Smith is the lead.
And... Or it's like Wild Wild West, where Will Smith is the lead, but Kevin Kline is the two-hander.
Yes. Very good.
It's not like After Earth, where Jaden Smith is the lead and Will Smith is the...
Or it's like I Am Legend, where Will Smith is the lead, but the dog is kind of us.
It's like the as-of-yet unfilmed I Am Legend 2, where Michael B. Jordan is the lead, but Will Smith is the... how many more of these can I pull up?
It's not like I, Robot, where Will Smith is the lead.
But
it's,
he doesn't have a two-hander in that one. It's just him.
Well, there's the robot! Robot. My God. It's also not like Gemini Man, where Will Smith is the lead and Will Smith is also the two-hander.
Did you watch Gemini Man?
Yes, I watched Gemini.
Did you watch Gemini? How many frames did you watch?
I don't think I watched it at the fucking 40, okay, you're, 50, no, 60 frames.
No, you're substantially bad under what you expect the amount of frames to be.
Understood.
So when I saw Gemini Man, I saw it in 120 frames per second.
Oh my God.
It was the craziest shit I've ever seen. The action scene's extremely fluid.
Yeah.
The problem with 120 frames per second, and I promise we'll get back to the best of times, is that when you're watching it, like, you're watching a close-up of Will Smith,
mm-hmm.
and that focus, like, the background's out of focus, as it would be, and there's, like, a guy moving in the background, and you keep getting distracted by him.
Because of its, like,
because
fluid
it's
motion.
So fluid, and you're like, is this guy going to come up and, like, stab him in the neck? Like, what's going on? And then it's just a background extra.
It's just a background extra. Interesting.
That's the problem. Anyway, I have the 4K disc of Gemini Man, which does play at 60 frames per second.
Do TVs have that capability?
Yes.
Okay.
A modern, like, OLED screen does. So okay. I can watch Gemini Man at
60 frames.
Yeah, it's, but, like, only half as many frames as they filmed it in. But
right. What was that whole point? To do the
it's
you know what? We don't have time.
No, we do. So the thing is that Ang Lee fell for the classic curse of the successful blockbuster director.
Yes,
the George Lucas, Robert Zemeckis, Peter Jackson Ang Lee approach, where they make a very successful movie and then decide that their next phase of their career, or the latter half of their career, is going to be pushing the art of film forward with new technologies.
Yeah.
And I want to emphasize, all these guys are doing it with great, noble intentions. The only one who succeeded is James Cameron, probably.
Yeah.
Actually, George Lucas. George Lucas is like, I am going to invent shooting movies on digital. Mm-hmm. And Attack of the Clones is the first movie shoot on digital.
Yeah.
First like major movie.
Yeah.
There's like obviously smaller ones that did before.
Yeah.
Peter Jackson, or Robert Zemeckis, I am going to redefine motion capture after I saw Gollum, and he makes Nightmare Fuel Polar Express.
Yeah.
And Jim Carrey, A Christmas Carol, which I will be going to Jim Carrey's house with a pitchfork and a torch to burn it down for that monstrosity. And then Peter Jackson is like, well, I'm going to do 48 frames per second for the Hobbit movies, and nobody likes it. And so they stop. By the third one, they don't release it in high frame rate.
Yeah.
And then Angley's like, well, Peter, clearly you were just chicken. You did 48. I'm going to do 120, baby, for Billy Lynn's long halftime walk.
Imagine the poor camera loader on that shoot.
I once heard someone describe Billy Lynn's long halftime walk, which is a good movie, actually.
Mm-hmm.
It's a drama that shot 120 frames per second. And the idea was that you could really like see every emotion the actor is portraying
mm-hmm.
With those additional frames. And a podcast I listened to described Vin Diesel's performance in that movie as you were able to see him thinking about the catering table. which is the problem is like, okay, there's a reason we have this divide of film.
Yeah.
Separating us from who these people really are. There is like the less frames, like, you know, filtrations, you know, different colors we add into this.
Yeah.
It does separate us in this nice like veil way to see the performance instead of the actor.
Well, I kind of think of it as like, I thought, was it Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse that played with frame rates very interestingly, where it's like before Miles Morales like is comfortable with his powers, a lot of the movies in 12 frames per second,
mm-hmm.
like in casual like animation style.
Yeah.
But then once he gets very comfortable with his powers, it switches to 24 frames per second.
Yeah. They do like some that. Frame rate stuff. They're doing like what's called modular frame rate as well, which is what Avatar The Way of Water did.
Okay.
Which is that instead of like, I'm trying to think of a good example. Like Billy Lynn's Long Halftime Walk, which is filmed at 120 frames per second and mm-hmm. projected in theory at 120 frames per second.
Mm-hmm.
Avatar The Way of Water, the whole movie is projected at 48 frames per second.
Mm-hmm.
If you saw it in a good theater.
Yeah.
However, what they did was different elements of the screen are all playing at different frame rates.
Oh.
And if they
weird.
Need to slow things, and so a lot of the time, because in theory that's just, you know, if there's a scene that they don't want to be in high frame rate, they just have two of every frame.
Hmm.
It still fits into the same time frame.
Yeah.
So
right.
your mind perceives it as 24 frames Whoa. Per second, even though it's projecting at 48.
That's trippy.
But then, like, if James Cameron's idea was, you know, people aren't buying the whole thing being high frame rate.
Yeah.
What if, like, I want you to be able to see this Na'vi fight this robot in better clarity, but I don't want you to be distracted by the rest of the frame. The rest of the frame is going to be at 24.
Yeah.
But I'm going to have all 48 frames for that fight happening.
My God.
You're not getting distracted by what's going on around, but you're locking in on just that fight, which looks very clear to you now.
The compositors on that alone.
It's crazy.
Fuck. Jesus Christ.
But Spider-Verse does the same thing but because they didn't want to go through the rigmarole of, well, you're only going to see this at like 48 if you go to certain theaters
mm-hmm.
or if you have the certain, like, you know, 4K disc at home. That movie is all 24. And then at certain points and certain elements, they have them like perceived as lower frame rates.
Hmm.
So like an earlier part, if they want him to seem a little slower,
yeah,
your mind is perceiving it as 12 frames per second, but it's really just two of every frame.
Oh, speaking of trippy filmography techniques, we should acknowledge that this is the first episode we're recording after David Lynch's passing.
Yes, I didn't want to talk about it.
we don't have to.
No, we can talk about it. He directed The Best of Times, and it was actually ghost-directed by him instead of Roger Spottiswoode, which is why halfway through this movie you go into Kurt Russell's dreams and there's a hellish reality. No.
I just know he was a big influence on you.
He was a big influence to me. Yeah.
Not to say I didn't like him. I just know
David Lynch is like my fucking guy, and I just finished reading his biography a week before he passed and watching all of his movies.
Wow.
Huge influence to me, and, you know, we commemorate him on this show. One thing that Travolting Podcast is a supporter of is David Lynch and having a sunshine day.
Good.
But to loop all this back, I hope the listener at home enjoyed this talk about frame rates.
Mister, we can have it all. What do we do now?
Ask him to turn the sound up. There's still the post-game highlights.
You are full of shit, Jack. In every way that it's possible for a person to be full of it, you are. Even your bullshit is bullshit. You know, you once said to me you liked the way I could command respect on a football team without saying much. Well, I was always amazed at the way you could make so much noise without doing anything. There's a style there, a confidence. And really, Jack, you're a decent human being, basically. You're just full of shit.
What are you implying, Reno?
That's what I mean. I'm not implying. I'm saying.
Kurt Russell named Reno in this movie.
Yes. What did you think of their
chemistry?
Of their chemistry.
They have really good chemistry.
Yeah.
I think they have really good chemistry.
Yeah.
I think, you know, Robin is still not, he's not turning it up to 100. He's not going full zany.
Right.
But what Kurt Russell's really good at, I mean, he's good at a lot of things.
Uh-huh.
But he, when he decides to just play a straight man, he's very good at it.
Yeah.
He's good at like not being like, he's good at grounding kind of the craziness around him.
Yeah.
It's a skill that really gets deployed in The Thing.
Uh-huh.
Like Kurt Russell's very subdued in The Thing.
Yeah.
But that helps ground you when all like ship starts, you know, going crazy in that movie.
Yeah.
And it's the same effect in this, except instead of a Cronenbergian monster from the depths of John Carpenter's imagination, it is Robin Williams on cocaine.
Right. No. Right.
Because he's like, Robin is allowed to go zany sometimes in this movie. Not too much.
To a degree, yeah. To a certain degree.
But Kurt Russell's kind of John Wayne Saunter coming in. You know, Jack, we can't win this game kind of delivery. Helps ground that, and it allows Robin to, you know, go a little more broad.
Yeah. This is giving a lot of, like, subdued survivors style. I think, like, it's best of times, and then we'll talk about this in Club Paradise, like, Robin is working with people who kind of allow him more so and more so to like do his kind of thing. But I think the problem is like he's been doing his thing as Mork for so long that he almost doesn't even realize what doing his thing on camera anymore means. I think that's a crucial thing. It comes more into play in Club Paradise, but I think it's also very evident in the Best of Times that I see Robin trying to like split the part of like being this like fanatical, like, thinking about this game that he should have won and how much it drives him nuts and crazy and like losing his sanity over it while also trying to be like the, I'm a bank teller. Like, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like him trying to split that. I can see he's like not quite threading the needle with that.
Yeah.
And like, but I think he has a harder job than Kurt Russell does.
I think Robin does have a harder job than Kurt Russell does. Kurt Russell is basically just playing like his thing in this movie.
Yeah, yeah. It's just Kurt Russell.
But I think Robin has a harder job. And I think where Robin is at his best, especially at this point, is like that clip you just played when he does those like kind of offhanded asides.
Yes.
Of like, well, don't worry, we still have the post-game highlights to watch. Like kind of those like little snide jokes are, I think, where he is.
The scene in the locker room in the game where he puts the mask on him and like hangs him up. That's like, I think that is the best scene in the movie, I think.
I think there's a better scene in this movie, but we'll talk about it when we go through it.
Okay. So this movie starts and we're seeing a replay highlight reel film.
So here's my first problem with this movie.
Uh-oh.
Is there's like a 5-minute like prelude at the start. It's like,
uh-huh. It is a long prelude.
It's truly like Galadriel-esque.
Yeah.
In terms of like, I can feel it in the water.
Galadriel-esque.
Like, it's like,
oh my goodness.
Like, the great, you know, the thing that makes the Lord of the Rings movies work is that opening prologue.
Yeah.
They have to dump so much shit on you. And the fact that Peter Jackson manages to make that work is the reason those movies work.
Yeah, I mean,
like it's just Cate Blanchett just like explaining essentially 2,000 years of fictional history to you?
Well, it seems like if The Fellowship was one movie budget, which I know it wasn't, but if The Fellowship was one movie budget, they put 60% of the budget into that flashback scene.
Yeah, because it's like a huge battle.
Battles, armies, and like volcano eruptions.
Now, all this to say, this fucking movie tries to do that same trick, except I don't give a shit about Taft, California. I'm sorry.
This
because it's like back in 1920, this was a like a small town, but then they found liquid gold, and it's like this, like we're like,
I forgot about this whole
2 minutes into this opening montage, and we are just now learning that it's an oil town. And because it's an oil town, a community sprung up, and what did they do for pastime? They played football. And there was a
notorious game between.
Well, no, not even that yet. There was
shit.
What's that fake? What's the famous guy's name?
The famous guy's name.
Because there's like the Kid Lester. They're like Kid Lester was the most famous football player, and we're in like the '20s at this point.
Okay.
Kid Lester was the most famous football player.
Christ.
But then he lost a game, and he retreated in shame and disappeared, and was never heard from again. And then,
does this matter?
For 50 years, and then it's like for many years after, football was the lifeblood of the town. But Taft never recovered after Kid Lester left, and we would get defeated by Bakersfield every year. And by this point, I'm like, okay, so we started with the 20s.
Yeah.
Well, this movie is set in the 50s, is what I'm assuming.
Okay.
Because like we just kind of jump into that time period.
Yeah.
It's like, but I lost the game, and it's like this really grainy black and white film. You know, there's a lot going on.
Yeah.
I'm like, okay, this movie's set in the 50s. And then it turns out the game was in 1972 and this movie's set in the 80s.
Yeah.
And I'm like, what was all this? What was all this business?
Giant time jump here.
Yeah. What do you mean? Like, why did we jump all the way back to the 20s for the football history?
It makes no sense. But so this takes place in a small town, Taft. Taft High School is the... And this is actually a real place in California where they shot it at. They shot this... around Taft Union High School, although the football scenes took place at Pierce Junior College in San Fernando Valley. The night game was filmed in Moore Park High School in Moore Park, California. But they did film a bulk of this in Taft, California.
Yeah.
Real place. And Bakersfield is also a real place. And those are their arrivals. It's like kind of closer, like the bigger suburb of Los Angeles is the thought of Bakersfield. While Taft is like the rural area.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah. And then they're going, and then we're at the game and, you know, we're getting all this narration from Robin voiceover. And, his full name is Jack Dundee, by the way.
Jack Dundee.
I think it's important to mention that. And in this game,
he's cousins to Crocodile.
And it's like a few seconds before the game's over. And
you didn't even flinch.
I will not blink as I walk through the valley of the shadow of death. And so the final seconds of the game. And then we later find out the quarterback, Reno, Kurt Russell, throws a perfect pass to Robin, Jack. And he drops it.
Yeah.
And then ever since then, he becomes known as the guy who dropped the ball.
Quite literally.
Oh, brother, this guy stinks!
And so he's basically never recovered.
He is now a bank teller. He's watching this at a side room connected to his office in this bank.
No, he's not just a bank teller. He is
a bank executive.
No, not just that.
Oh.
He has what's the term? He has like kind of cucked himself.
Because he works for his dad.
He works for the head coach, the owner of the Bakersfield football team.
That's so weird. Like, so is he the coach?
Who is also his wife's father.
Yeah, he's the father-in-law. So there's a point at the beginning of this where right as soon as Robin gets out of that like side room, I think, is this movie going to cook? Because I see him like looking all dweebish.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, this could be really interesting. This could be really fun. But then the movie doesn't really, like you mentioned, like all this history about Taft.
Yeah.
None of it's relevant.
Yeah. The
whole oil field bit.
It's not relevant until the last frame when it turns out that Kid Lester came back and magically caused rain during the game.
And you know what else that could have been? It could have just been it rained.
But like, this movie is playing into the classic, like, you know, tropes of comedies, especially of this era, which are so much about like men getting castrated and even needing to like get their groove back.
Yeah. It, the whole bit of like, it, you know, in the first 5 minutes, what the last scene of this movie is going to be that, oh, well, of course they're going to replay the game.
Yeah.
Now, I didn't realize that they were going to get all the old players back.
Which is good.
Which is good.
Yes.
But then they also got the old players back from Bakersfield, who are all also very physically fit, one of which is a parole
guy. Yeah, he's a guy from prison.
And so a lot of this movie, like, it stretched imagination, of course. But even still, like, as Robin's, like, pitching this idea, like, I want to replay this game. And we also get introduced to Reno Hightower.
Yes. Of no relation to the Hightowers of Westeros.
House of the Dragon.
What if, like, you watch what if House of the Dragon season 3 comes
Stop.
Out?
Stop.
And it's like,
I'm not interested in this.
Rizifans, I think that's how you say his name. And
what?
Rizifans, he plays Otto Hightower in House of the Dragon.
Okay.
Rizifans and Olivia Cooke, who is Allison Hightower. And it's the two of them, and they're like, we have brought our cousin in to help lead the armies of Westeros. And like, Kurt Russell saunters in. He's like, hey, it's me, Reno Hightower from Taft, California.
You're saying some true wisdom here, because imagine Kurt Russell in a Game of Thrones episode. Just like a little like cameo.
I genuinely don't think his energy would work.
That's the point, Jeff. Yeah. Is it wouldn't work.
But it'd be really fucking funny.
Fucking funny, though.
So he's like, yeah, I'm going to run this town.
We have to travel the army at nightfall. Make sure the dragons don't spot
us. Let me get the V-dub beetle in the back. I'll drive it out there. He's like, with the dragons flying over him.
The wall is made of Valyrian steel. Only the strongest dragon
Let
of
me
ours
get my
can...
soldering iron out. Take care of it. Reno Hightower.
Reno Hightower.
Member of the small table, whatever they call it.
Kurt Russell, who he's a mechanic.
He's a mechanic.
And
who owns his own business. This is important.
Right. And he's in debt to the bank that Jack is working for.
Yes.
His wife,
Gigi,
leaves him again.
Yes. Gigi is his high school sweetheart.
Yeah.
It's later revealed that like she got pregnant in basically like their senior year. She was the homecoming queen and he was the star football player. And now they've both just kind of gotten into this rut in their lives, living in a trailer.
Mm-hmm.
Where like she wants to go to Los Angeles and become a singer, and he's content to just run this little mechanic shop in Taft and never move on from his high school years.
Yeah.
It's about these two guys who need to like, who are living in the past.
Yeah.
And I think that this movie, the thing this movie is missing is a deep sadness. It constantly is like tapping on it.
Yeah.
But then it reels back and it goes back to just being funny.
Yeah.
Like, I think this movie could excel. Like, there's like this one transcendent scene in this movie where Gigi like performs at the local bar. She sings that she's sure the boy I love.
Mm-hmm.
And like Kurt and Jack are just in the crowd, like kind of absorbing this and like thinking about, you know, how they used to be the men on top, and they're just living in that memory.
Yeah.
And hopes that that memory can like come back, all the while ignoring like that they're preventing themselves from finding something new.
I really don't think this movie is that smart, Jeff.
No, the thing is, one scene of this movie is that smart, and then the movie's like, we're going back. We're reeling it back, and we're going to go back to being, you know what? They're going to play their last football game, and they're going to win it this time, and they're going to be like, you know what? We really were the shit in high school, and then they're all going to get married again. I don't know.
It's really
there's a version of this movie that really leans into that sadness.
Yeah.
While still being funny.
Well, speaking of like a older dude looking back on his like times in high school, Dead Poets Society, like, which is like Robin kind of fitting in that sort of role in that side too. But yeah, so I'm trying to think like, he goes to visit a massage expert on the edge of town. This is Jack, Robin Williams. And he's like during this whole thing complaining about the game. And that's when she gives like the recommendation, like, well, why don't you just replay the game? And Robin, rather than like dismissing this idea, like latches onto it so quickly. That's the thing is like, I feel like Robin's character needed to be convinced of this.
Mm-hmm.
Not that Robin needs to convince everybody else.
Yeah.
I don't know. It just seemed kind of weird that like because we're seeing it through his eyes.
Yeah.
And I get that like Kurt Russell is the titular character that he has to convince to like agree to redo this game. But it's also like watching this Robin play this man who from the first third of the movie onward is trying to convince the whole town to go in on replaying this high school game. I don't know. It just didn't feel like that was the right speed for me. It seemed like if anything, like there needed to be like a rumor floating around and everybody joking with him. And then like the midpoint of the movie, it's like, you know what? Fuck it. We will replay this game. Like, oh, we were kidding, Robin. It's like, no, we're replaying this game. Like, I don't know. So he goes to his father-in-law and proposes a rematch. And his father-in-law is like, but he's like, yeah, sure. You know, on Bakersfield's behalf, I agree and we'll crush you again.
Yeah.
And so at this point, his wife is trying to tell him that he should not do this game. And if he does, then he can't sleep in the house. So he goes to a motel.
They both get kicked out to the motel.
I have to read a line from the Wikipedia because I think it's kind of funny.
I also want to note that his father-in-law is the commander from The Thing. Yes. Turns out to be one of the things.
Yes. It's good.
So Kurt Russell's just like, motherfucker.
The line I have to read here is, because Reno is the greatest quarterback in the history of South Kern County and the only one to wear white shoes, Jack tries to get him on board. The best, greatest quarterback in the history of South Kern County.
Yes.
The only one to wear white shoes. And so Robin goes to Kurt Russell, and of course, Kurt Russell's like, that's a stupid idea. And he's like, well, I can reorganize your mortgage payments because I work at the bank. I'm like, okay, fine. Like, just like that, basically. Yeah. Then
there's a lot of business in the middle.
There is a lot of business in the middle. Basically, like, everything else I'm going to describe, it's like blah, 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 blah.
Because they get all the old team players back, but then none of them have a personality. There's just, like, background extras, essentially.
Yeah.
To the extent, like, they'll point at one and be like, hey, Tommy, and Tommy will just, like, kind of shake his head, and you're like, oh, you're just an extra. They didn't pay you SAG minimum.
Yeah. The one thing that I almost missed and didn't catch till later was that so at a point they get back, they go to the bar and they get back to the lodge and they find it vandalized. Yes. They think it was done by Bakersfield.
And you do see Tony the Tiger running around doing it, which is, but you know that it's Robin.
Exactly. It's Robin in the costume. He's trying to like incite a mob.
An insurrection
against Bakersfield. But that's like kind of what drives everybody to get on board with this. So then we get like a classic workout montage that lasts for 2.5 minutes. Robin's running.
Mm-hmm.
That's that. Just Robin's running.
There's the dinner table scene, which I think is great.
This is a good scene. I actually do like this scene.
Because they have a parlay with their wives.
Yeah.
That they're going to come over back to the house for dinner.
Under one condition.
Two conditions.
Well,
they cannot talk about football and they cannot talk about sex.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
And so they all come in and they just sit around. They don't know what, none of them know what to talk about.
And they try to like position the TV in the background behind the wives.
Yeah. What I like is the Jack's wife just being like, so how about the Middle East? And Robin's like, oh, it's a swamp. I don't know what to do over there. They're like, what about, I forget what other countries they talk about.
Russia.
They talk about like Russia. And he's like, oh, that's a swamp too. It's like they just keep bringing up all these problems. Over Robin's friends is, yeah, it's a swamp. I don't know what we're gonna do about it.
Yeah.
All the while they're trying to position the TV behind the wives so they can watch the game.
Yeah. They of course they get found out and both guys get kicked out
again.
They go to the bar and that's where the clip that I played for you earlier, where Kurt Russell just kind of calls him out on his bullshit. And then it's the game.
Yeah.
Like, we pretty much got through like 75% of this whole movie. Yeah.
This is around the point where I drank a beer and then the movie got substantially more interesting to me.
Yes.
This is at the end of my odyssey.
So the first half, the Taff Rockets are getting crushed by the Bakersfield Tigers. 0 to 26. And then, so basically, Reno, well, Jack Robin is like crushed. He's like faltering under pressure.
Mm.
There's like a scene where he's like, okay, you're being covered by the Dr. Death. And he's like, Dr. Death? I thought he was in jail. Like, he just got out on parole. And Robin's like just cracking under pressure, not able to deliver. And he's trying to tell Reno, it's like, I can get open. Robin says that a lot in this game scene. It's like, I can get open.
Yeah.
But then at that point, Kurt Russell takes Robin out of the game.
Yeah.
And he's sitting on the bench.
It's because Kurt finds out during halftime that
yes.
Robin was the Tiger.
Yes.
And so he puts his white shoes back on.
Yeah.
And that anger inspires him because everyone's like, when he was a prick, he was a good player. But now that he's nice, he's not good anymore.
Yeah, exactly. His meanness returns, spurring the team to catch up little by little.
Now, here's what I inherently think is the biggest problem, failing of this movie.
Is that they should have lost?
He should have caught the ball, but they should have lost still. It should be a Rocky-type ending.
Yeah.
Where Rocky goes the distance, but he loses.
Yeah.
But instead, they get it all. They win, and he catches the ball.
And he catches the ball, yeah.
Like, the ending of this movie should not be, oh, well, we actually are still as good as we were in high school.
Right.
The end of this movie should be, like, he gets to, you know, fix that sin of his past and move on.
Yeah.
And, like, the father-in-law can still be like, we beat your asses. And he can be like, I don't care anymore.
I don't care
anymore. I caught the ball.
Yeah.
That's how you end. That's how I feel you should end this movie.
Right.
That's, like, kind of a bittersweet ending. Where Robin and Reno get to move on from their past.
It's so not the tone of it's the not movie the, we've been watching.
It's not
though.
The tone of the movie. And that's like the problem is this movie needs a different tone.
Yeah.
This movie needs to be it's still funny. It's still like charming enough.
Yeah.
But there's like moments where this movie could be more.
Of course. Like, so eventually, Kurt puts Robin back in the game. It's tied up and he goes for the long pass and he catches it and he gets the touchdown and they win. And
this is a movie that must play like gangbusters in bars in small town Indiana communities where there's a bunch of guys who have not moved on from their high school football years.
I imagine there are some straight up dudes in my hometown in Indiana who still recount their games.
There are most certainly.
You know what my favorite, can I go on a little tangent? Yeah. You know what my least favorite thing about like some of like high school, college sports things is? When you call another team your rival, but what that just means is you never beat them.
Yes.
That is not a rival. Yeah. Rivals are when it's back and forth and you're on equal footing. But like my high school, Huntington North, I pray to fucking God you're all listening, you motherfucking cocksuckers, okay? Because you keep calling Homestead High School your rivals and Homestead beats us year after year.
Yeah. It's
they're not rivals.
Yeah, they just beat you.
They just beat us every year.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, that's
no, I feel you.
But I know there are some fucking 40, 50-year-old dudes be like, that. If I had just caught that pass from the...
I will ultimately say, I think I'm just interested in a different movie than what this is trying to sell.
Yeah.
I'm saying all these things that I think would make this movie better, but ultimately that's not what this movie's trying to
exactly.
do.
Exactly. Like, that would almost be... If we had the same movie, but then it had the ending you described, it'd make me more mad at the movie. Because it's like, at the very least, at least they stayed in line with the tone of the movie they were making, which... Of course, the ending, like, it's not a good ending, but the movie's not a good movie. Like, it's sort of safe. But if they ended that way, I'd be like, well, what the fuck, guys? Like,
no, I still think it would have worked.
I just think like, with the tone of the movie they've been, like, projecting, and then to do that, like, nuanced ending, I'm like, that should have been the whole movie.
Yes.
And that's why I would have been more angry.
Yeah.
So, like, the whole movie is kind of a blah.
Now, like, imagine if you were to play this movie, like I said, in one of those small bars, they'd be like, fuck yeah. And then they would try and do it, but they would break their leg in the process. And it would be
training,
really sad for old Greg.
I think about that scene in Rocky Balboa when he's talking to his trainer and he's like, all right, so you can't do high jumps because of your torn ACLs. You can't do huge weightlifting because of your torn shoulder muscles. So that means we're going to just do cardio, like, or weight.
Yeah, <there's no> punch.
Do you remember that scene?
Yeah.
He's like, we're just gonna lift weights.
Yeah.
That's gonna be your training.
Yeah.
And so But yeah,
he loses in Rocky Balboa, right?
He does.
Okay, good.
But it's the exact same thing of Rocky One, where he goes the distance, but he loses.
Okay, good. Blah, blah, blah. That's what I thought.
That movie's whole tone is that.
Yeah, that movie's whole tone is that he's not trying to win. He's just trying to prove that he's not washed up yet.
Yeah. That's such a good movie.
That's a good movie.
Yeah.
It's very weird. The Rocky franchise is so weird.
It is very weird.
We'll probably never do Stallone on this show. That's because he's retired from acting, because he's too busy being the ambassador to Hollywood.
That's right.
One of the three ambassadors to Hollywood.
What is it? Him and John Voight.
It's him and John Voight and Mel Gibson.
That's right. Yeah.
Who are the three guys who are going to save the film industry.
And that leads us to our sponsor of this podcast, Ivermectin.
Yeah. No, it is worth bringing up. Our first episode of the show was recorded days after the Biden inauguration, and we said this is a Biden era podcast. This is our first podcast recorded after the second Trump inauguration. This is now a Trump era podcast.
Which is why we will
be talking about MyPillow. So have you ever fought troubled sleep? No.
No, stop. It's perfect. We're talking about Robin, who a lot of his jokes.
We've deleted all of our social media accounts except for X and Truth Social.
I just want you, like, I wasn't going to play this clip until next week for Club Paradise, but I'm going to play this clip from Robin Williams in Evening at the Met.
Yeah.
The whole thing, and at the top of the heap, there's Ronald Reagan with a look in his eyes like they're going to put swinging doors into Congress. So it's going to be... I'm back and I'm pissed off. He's got that look in his eyes. Here's a president that said, what would this country be without this great land of ours? Wait a minute.
Imagine if he was still alive during the Trump administration.
Oh my
Holy
God.
Fuck. He'd go on tour again. Anyway. So that's the movie. Comes out January 31st, 1986, distributed by Universal.
Yes.
The budget was $12
million. Makes no money whatsoever.
Box office was just shy of $8 million. So
it's a flop.
It's a flop. It loses
Another
money.
Flop for Robin.
Basically, a lot of the reviews are saying that, you know, it's a very bleh kind of a movie. Maybe the best thing is, you know, that Williams and Russell are pretty good together in it. And that's about all there is. The movie makes no headway. Doesn't really.
This movie has developed like kind of a weird cult following.
It has.
Among like sports movie fans.
But to the crowd that you previously described.
The crowd I'm describing.
The small rural Midwest town dudes who watch this.
The guy who's like,
bar.
You know, I could have gone pro if I really wanted to. And I'm like, could you?
Could you?
Did you really want to then?
No, you didn't. so, yeah. I don't know.
Pauline Kael from The New Yorker, weirdly, one of the like most infamous critics of her time, weirdly likes this movie. She's like, it's glorious, glorious foolishness.
Yeah.
But overall, it's just like, it's one of those many non-existent comedies from the 80s that just really doesn't have much of a cultural legacy.
Mm-hmm.
And it starts these, like, it's one of those movies that I would never have heard of if we hadn't done this podcast. We get a lot of movies like this.
But yeah.
All that being said, I didn't hate it, and I generally enjoyed the process of watching, even if I was very distracted.
I was able to at least like remember most of the plot points in this movie, which is a credit to itself. But yeah, like this movie, no one's gonna like think of Robin Williams or Kurt Russell and think the best of times. Like it just doesn't come up in anybody's like brain when they think about a movie like this. Yeah, I mean, there's not much like post-text in terms of what comes after, because what comes right after is this next movie, Club Paradise, which comes out 6 months later in July.
It's just Robin's like in this churn of like
trying
low to,
like, to
mid-tier comedy.
Yeah, but he's like he's trying in all these movies. He's always like trying something. These two, like this movie and next week, Club Paradise, it's like him trying to like dig through all the muck to find a gem somewhere.
Yeah, he's like kind of just subsisting in comedies right now.
Yeah.
It's like you don't really get movies like this anymore. Like most comedies are just like kind of shafted to Netflix, or they just don't really get major releases.
Right.
There aren't that many comedies being made that aren't TV shows.
Right.
But like, this used to be like a time where just like they would just churn out comedies like this. Mm-hmm. And Robin's just in that churn right now.
And this is like
until someone finally figures out how to synthesize that comic persona that's becoming so big,
right,
onto a, you know, celluloid silver screen.
Yeah. And this is like the more sedentary part of Robin's work relationship right now, as he's putting more time and focus into his comedian role, which, as I've been saying, has been blowing up right now. So like I don't want to walk away from this thinking like, oh, Robin's in a bad place right now. It's like he's winning Grammys for his comedy albums. Like he's doing okay. Just not that great in like the film
there's
aspect
like
of his career.
A lot of comedians who never really
make that jump.
Like I think of like Jerry Seinfeld.
Yeah.
Like Seinfeld was one of the biggest shows, very successful stand-up comic. I don't know if he ever really had like, besides B movie, he
will
never
not
really
let
had
you
like
disrespect B movie.
He never really had like a big film career.
Yeah.
Same thing for like looking at some examples like Bill Burr and John Mulaney are two big stand-up comics right now.
Yeah.
And like they've been in movies.
Yeah.
They've been quite good in movies,
mm-hmm.
but they're guys who just haven't really translated to like big film careers.
Yeah.
In that way. And so Robin's in that place right now where it's like, will he ever have a big film career?
Maybe.
Stay tuned.
Stay tuned.
It'd be funny if he didn't and we were just covering just some fucking guy who did movies like this.
Parallel universe, man. I don't have any other final thoughts. Do you have any final thoughts?
Yeah, no, I think I've more or less said my piece about the best of times.
All right. Well,
I do want to say really quick the Sure the Boy I Love is a great song that Gigi sings in this movie, and it made me very hyped during that one scene. And then they play it again over the end credits, and I got really happy.
Good.
Oh, and Emmett Walsh is in this movie, and he's great. When's he bad? That's all I have to say. That's all I have to say.
Well, thank you all for listening to The Best of Times 1986. We hope you've enjoyed this episode. We stretched it out to an hour long, you know?
Good for us.
This is definitely one of those that we could have probably cut and dry in 30 minutes.
Yeah. You know what next week's episode will not be? An hour long.
This episode will probably not be an hour long. But we still hope you join us next week for Club Paradise.
Yes.
Where the first opening scene of that movie takes place in our gilded Silver City, Chicago, Illinois, with a nice shot going over a very popular intersection that you and I caught right away.
Yeah.
Join us next week for Club Paradise. As always, special thanks to Rebecca for the graphic design, Michael Van Bodegan Smith for the theme music that's taking you out. Remember to follow us at Blue Sky. Are we going to keep our Meta accounts? Probably Instagram.
Probably keeping Instagram.
Yeah. Instagram's hard to let go.
Yeah.
Follow us on Blue Sky. I think we are on Threads, kind of. Go to our Reddit. Please go to our Reddit. It makes me sad.
Go to the Reddit. It's a little funny, right?
Yeah. Thank you all for listening. We'll see you next week for Club Paradise.
Bye.